So you really need to question whoever is making that recommendation to you, what is their framework? If their framework is this fiat system that says you should eat these foods and you should go into debt and go to school and you should do this and this, and I think it's a first principle thing. You just need to ask, what is it that you're really getting out of those things? And what is your real opportunity cost for that? And if you do that, then I think what it comes down to is making the commitment.
Welcome to Life with Bitcoin, where we delve into the human side of Bitcoin by focusing on Bitcoiners' personal transformations and life stories. I'm your host, Vivian. Thanks for tuning in. If you like and want to support our mission on shining light on the human side of Bitcoin, remember to subscribe to this channel, leave a comment, or send a few stats from the link in the description. Today, we're welcoming two guests, Scott and Tally Lindberg. Scott is a serial board game designer in Bitcoin, author of Teaching Through Games, 21 Bitcoin Lessons, and he's also the co-host of Bitcoin Homeschoolers podcast, along with Tally. Tally is the host of Orange Hatter podcast for Bitcoin women. She's the author of Super K Early Reader Books, organizer of the Orange Hatter Women's Retreat, and co-organizer of Louise Wells Bitcoiner Network Meetup. Welcome, Tally and Scott.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for taking the time. You both are very fascinating individuals. Looking forward to dive into this.
Let's go.
Scott, you're a game designer. Can you give us a brief introduction of what is the Huddle Up game?
So Huddle Up is just intended to be a fun family style game that you can learn in 15 minutes and finish in 45 minutes or an hour. So you could compare that to maybe a Catan. It's not meant to be super intense, but I wanted something that was both fun, but I also wanted it to be based on Bitcoin, because I was building that game while I was learning Bitcoin, and I was also trying to teach Tali and get her to open up about listening to podcasts or books. At the time, she didn't really seem that interested in it. She was very focused on where the kids were and the kids' activities. So the game itself is a mixture of strategy and luck. So you do plan out, do you want to do a cold storage strategy? Do you want to do a hashing strategy and collect more mining rigs? But the essence of the game is it's a time chain. It has 21 million Bitcoin with a couple halving events along the way. And when you make transactions to get the reward, the Bitcoin moves between the players. So your job is to huddle up the most Bitcoin by the end of the game.
And before you designed the game, you were a long-term board game hobbyist. So what about board game in general that you like?
First of all, I'm just familiar with it because I grew up with board games, and that's just what I knew. The second thing is there's a fellowship side to it. So especially during COVID, when everybody was doing everything virtually, you got an intense experience of not being able to sit down with other people. And I think that's something that we really miss in families. I think we miss that at work. I think we just miss that in general. So the best part about games is spending time with people. Sometimes it's getting to know new people you've never met. And sometimes it's sitting down with, maybe it's your family, maybe it's some other Bitcoiners. But to me, it's the fellowship side. And obviously, Tali and I focus on the education because as homeschoolers, we're passionate about that. But the game itself and why I like games, a huge part of it is you're spending time with people either you want to get to know better or that you already care about.
You went to West Point for system engineering. And I think you're the first person I'm talking to that I've talked to have actually gone to West Point. You know, like I grew up in Beijing and I've learned this name via different American movies. And then they would have this main character show up and then some other senior commanders and say, hey, this is your new commander from West Point. And this is like my first impression of West Point. So it's my understanding is that it's a military school and it has a really heavy military background. Do you remember what was the thing that caught your attention and made you have that hunch, I have to come here in the first place? And basically, what is the difference between West Point, a military sort of school, and a conventional university?
So you're actually in the Army. When you're a cadet, you're actually in the Army, and your rank is cadet. and you are in uniform. You are underneath the Uniform Code of Military Justice. So if you do something wrong, it's not just your local or federal laws that you could get in trouble for. You're underneath the Uniform Code of Military Justice. So you're in the Army, basically. You just happen to wear a different uniform than others. So you have a uniform that you wear to class, which is different than the uniform you wear when you are going to the gym to exercise. So if you're on post, you're basically in uniform. In your room, obviously, you could relax a little bit. But your room had to be a certain way. You had to wear a uniform. You had to abide by a very strict set of rules and procedures. And it's its own ecosystem. There's a whole cadet rankings structure. So you start as a plebe and you're reporting up. And then those people, when they get to higher levels, they're over more cadets. And so there's a leadership experiment where you get to participate and try to lead others. And you watch people do it poorly and you watch them do it well, and you get to try it yourself. So the whole thing is meant to be an exercise in leadership.
Wow. Do you have like PE classes, like for physical trainings?
You do. So here, to put in context, if you're at a regular school, you would have your grade point average, and that's probably how you're comparing yourself to others. So at West Point, you have a physical grade. And that'll be how well you did on physical tests, like the indoor obstacle test. You have the standard Army physical test. You have your different classes. So boxing is required, and there's swimming is required. There's certain things that are required to do. And then if you're not in a varsity sport, you're also required to be in intramurals. And so you have a physical standing in the class. You have a military standing in the class because you're every semester you're also getting graded on whatever position you're in. So you're literally being, imagine a forced curve on your leadership style, and all your peers are also leaders. So there's a lot of intense pressure to work together as a team, but also to try to stand out because you want to do better on that. And then finally, you have your academics. So you have an academic standing, and you take those three, and they're weighted heavier on the academics, but there's a weighting system. And then you have your physical, your military, and your academic, and they all go into your overall ranking. And then that becomes important because that's how you're going to, there's certain branch selections in the Army, and where your first duty stations are going to be based on this ranking in your class. So yes, the physical is a huge part of the expectations and part of the cadet life.
Because if we think about countries with those mandatory military service, they end up being, the men end up being stronger and healthier in their later life because they spent a couple years doing intense exercising and really pushed to their limit as a young adult physically, so that their body kind of remembers that and kind of serves them well in later years. So I definitely see value of that. But did you find the ranking system, because it's almost kind of like a social experiment where you put people who are like undergrad age, basically 18 to 22, 23 years old in this environment, and then you rank them, and then they have different classes and they have to abide certain rules. In first year high school, it's a mandatory thing to go to do this military training thing for like a week for me. Mm. And I went and I hated it. I hated it so much. The fact that you have to report before you want to go to the bathroom, and if a mosquito land on your face, you cannot move because you're in a role. And then you have to get up at a certain time, go to bed at a certain time. There's very the personal freedom, which is what I'm a freedom maximalist, and I felt really constrained in that environment, and I wasn't happy. And that 7 days felt like a really long time, and I was miserable. So I was just trying to understand, as a young adult, normal people going to conventional universities, they're partying, they're doing sports, they're hanging out with people, like doing band and going to clubs. Like you probably wouldn't have access to a lot of that or the freedom to do a lot of that. So did you find that restricting, or this is what you wanted?
So I found, especially my first year, that they call it your plebe year. I had a miserable first year, but there's something. So everybody has the same haircut. You're wearing the same clothes. There's a very, you're part of a bigger institution, and that institution is part of history. So one of their expressions was, much of the history we teach was made by the people we taught. So there's this pride that you're with other people, and you build, by going through something difficult, you build very strong relationships with them. So the experience itself often just sucks. And I didn't like a lot of the things that you're describing, and cadets certainly make fun of those things. However, they also look back, and if you listen to some of their favorite war stories of people who have graduated, and say, tell me whatever experience it was that they had, academic or military or whatever it was. And some of those roughest times are the ones that they'll most proudly refer to. And they all went through it together. So you come from all the different states. We had some people from other countries, and you're all just part of this what's, and then you become part of history because you're part of the long gray line. So it's a long way of saying, yes, there were times of part of that that I definitely did not like. I would never trade that experience for anything, though. It really did. It does make a huge impact on you, and I just wouldn't trade it for anything.
And this is part of parents' rules too, because kids cannot be low time preference, because their view of time, their lifetime is shorter, because they're still growing, and then they cannot see what's ahead of them. And it's all oftentimes up to parents to put them through short-term pain, in a way, to put them through short-term suffering, so they land to a place in the future where they look back and say, oh, I would never trade that experience to anything else, even though I really, like, was miserable in that experience. Hallie, like, what do you think is the fundamental purpose of games in general, and how do you think game plays in a role in your process of homeschooling?
I think that the most important aspect of game is to teach while the kids don't realize they're being taught. And this is something that I really had to relearn, because the Asian culture is very top-down and high pressure and memorize this, I'm going to test you, then you're going to be ranked, all that stuff, right? But what I learned, I think my most important lesson when the kids were little was I brought them to this place called Little Leapers, and it's gymnastics for kids that are just able to walk. I mean, we're talking young kids. And I was like, how can you possibly teach kids gymnastics? But I heard a lot of good things about it. They were doing brachiation. I'm like, let's go do gymnastics. Not because I wanted them to learn gymnastics per se, but that it's supposed, like, the cross body movement is supposed to be really good for brain development, vision, all that stuff, right? Asian stuff. I'm like, gotta give them that leg up. Mm. But what I realized was, you know, if you think gymnastics, immediately you're thinking the backflips and the cartwheels and things like that. I'm like, how do you teach that to kids? And they just made everything a game. Like, so they didn't say, let me teach you about cartwheel, here's step 1 through 10. They just said, first they need to, like, strengthen the muscles in their arms, right, and their wrist. And so they just bear crawl. And they just said, okay, be like a bear. And they just, the kids are, oh, this is so good, this is so fun. And they're crawling around. And then after that, they're like, okay, now crawl like you're a worm. And then they're on their belly, they're crawling, and they're working these muscles, you know. And so they go, and it's a half an hour class. They've done all these things. They're just pretending to be different animals, which is a game to them. But what they're walking away with is that their muscles are getting stronger, to the point that eventually they can then, you know, put one leg up, you know, when their hands are down. And then eventually the teacher will help them put their legs over. And so it's like this very slow buildup of skill set and strength. And I think that's the most important thing about games, is it allows students or players or kids to participate in an activity, and they're gaining something without being told that they are. Because the moment, like, any parent would tell you, the moment you tell your kids to do something, that's the thing that they don't want to do. Mm. That resistance, it's like a knee-jerk reaction. They don't even think about it. It's just like, mom says, go eat that vegetable. I'm like, no, I hate vegetables, you know? But if you make it a game, you're like, oh, look, it's a little tree. Can you take a little bite off the side of the tree? You know, make it smaller? And then suddenly, like, I can take a bite out of the tree and make it smaller. And then they take a bite. And so I think, in his way, when he's talking about a board game, you go through this process of 45 minutes and you're learning all of these lessons, like HODL UP is teaching you the fundamentals of Bitcoin. But if you back your way up and you go younger, you can do games that are 3 minutes long, 5 minutes long, and they're still walking away with really valuable lessons. And I think that's the important thing about games.
Yeah, if I could add to that. So for Huddle Up, the intent of that is you can play that game and never talk about Bitcoin. You can just play it. And if you're a Bitcoiner, you'll see all the mechanics. You'll get it. That's difficulty dial, that's hot and cold, wallet, having, whatever you want, it's in there. But you don't have to. And one of the things we do when the kids are younger is we force them to play a game called Cash Flow, which was by Robert Kiyosaki, which actually does a really great job of teaching about the three main financial statements. It actually does a really great job. But we had to threaten them and bribe them with jelly beans, and it was not a fun game by itself. And so what I...
They found it unrelatable because they were so young and they're talking about mortgage calculations and things like that. It's harder.
No, my point is that when you say top down and you say, this is a game and it's here to educate you, you're shutting someone down. If you say, here's a game and you're just playing, you just happen to have incorporated things about Bitcoin, or you just happen to have incorporated things about Lightning or seed phrases or whatever it is your topic is, because there's games out there on every subject. There's science, there's math, there's history, there's everything. But if you tell someone, especially imagine a middle schooler, this game is to help you learn something. It's an education game. It's instantly not fun. Right. It's not. Now it's work. Yeah. But if you said it's free time and here are your games, and you go and play Go or some other game that's very strategic, and you're actually exercising some type of cognitive thing, you're actually problem solving, you're doing strategy, you're work, whatever that is. Another thing about games is it forces that social skills, whether you're going to have to interact with others when you're in person, without saying this is a class on how you interact with others, because you just shut people down. So when I hear Tali talk about top down, That's where you just took a syllabus and you forced it into a different format and tried to tell someone that it was a game. And that's not my philosophy. And from the game side, it's not Tali's philosophy from the parenting side. If you can do something without telling them this is your lesson in this, and it's just a story, or it's just a game, or it's just an experience, they're more likely to do it. And they're really good at picking up themes. Kids will pick up things really fast. You don't have to explain it to them. First of all, they're going to figure out the game before the adults anyway, but they're going to figure out the themes and they'll make the connections with the other things. So if your goal is to have an impact, it's almost counterintuitive, but the best thing to do is to shut up and play.
I can totally relate to that. This is so true. Like when I was growing up, my parents never cared about me watching TV and stuff. So I would watch like dramas all the time on TV. And then one day it was like 4 or 5 years old. It was definitely before school. It was at kindergarten. And I went to my mom and picked up a newspaper. Mom, I can read this. And she didn't believe me. And then I read the news to her and she was like, holy shit. Well, not in those words, but she was really surprised how I could read newspaper all of a sudden. And it turned out I was all of the TV drama I was watching. So in China, we have subtitles for all of the TV series. And then I was listening. I was just enjoying the drama. And then the subtitle was just showing on the lower third. And I don't even remember doing it actively, but I just naturally pick up. And then one day I just suddenly realized, oh, I understand what this means. And then I told my mom, I can read this newspaper. So it happened like that. So kids definitely have this thing where they naturally pick up things around them. If you give them the space to learn and to play, then they oftentimes surprise you. And then you touch on expectation management, basically, because everything in a way is about expectation management. If you tell them this is work, even if it's a fun game, people are going to think, oh, I'm working and I'm not so into this. But if you frame it as this is fun, this is a game and you're here to play and have fun, then people can be more receptive and just enjoy the experience and have the knowledge as the byproduct. And it almost reminded me, I was just thinking about this today and how working in Bitcoin now which day in the week doesn't matter anymore. Because, you know, some people get the depression. It's Sunday evening and they're like, oh, Monday again. I have to get up, I have to go to work. And, you know, this is endless, it's pointless. They really get the Sunday, Monday depression. It's a real thing. And I was thinking, like, how I never get that. I never get that. So tomorrow is Monday. I get up at 7. It's fine. Like, I don't mind. And for Friday, I don't get particularly excited either because I have things to do anyways on the weekend. It's so the weekdays and weekend kind of get blurred in a good way because now because I'm doing something I really enjoy, it doesn't feel like work. It doesn't feel like I'm selling my time to whatever to make money so I can support myself. It feels like I'm doing something I'm really passionate about and enjoy and making an impact. And I look forward to that. So that's what our mental framework do to us. And talking about mental framework, when you're designing a game, you have control over every element. There's so much, of course, you have to work with certain constraints, but you have so much control as well. So this is almost like activating the God mode. So how does the experience of God mode influence your perspective on your own life?
It's not, I don't know what Tali's shaking her head about there. The problem I had is that I would get too excited about all the things I really wanted to share with somebody or with players. And invariably, the first version is always too complex. Almost, I don't think I've ever started the game and said, oh, that wasn't hard enough, right? And then usually it takes two or three of these things where I am disappointed because there's some element I really wanted to have in the game and it was just way too much. So I wanted to have transaction fees and HODL up. Well, man, it's hard enough already just to teach. Here's your mining reward with it. If I would have thrown that on top. So I had to keep peeling things off and taking it out and taking it out. The lightning game, it was the same thing. In spades, I was all this information I want to have in there. I want to make it as good as possible. So it's almost the thing you're describing isn't one of those things where you go, oh my gosh, I have all this power. It's more a frustration because you have more things you want to share, and it takes a lot to let go of something or force yourself to put it in a simpler format. Which at the end of the day is what actually helps people learn anyway. Because if I just dumped on you everything I've known after studying Bitcoin for 4 or 5 years or whatever it is, and you knew nothing about Bitcoin, you're going to glaze over and get zero out of it. If I could tell you just one thing and you walk away with that one thing, at least you've taken a step forward. So the God mode or whatever you want to call it, to me it's more of a thing that will paralyze you if you care about what the theme is that you're trying to get across.
And this is interesting because now I'm asking you about God mode, activating God mode. And you're telling me that it's no fun because you're in a position working with so many constraints and decision-making overload. And then you have so much information that you want to pass down, but you only have so much space and capacity. And someone's attention. It's basically, it feels like exactly what it is to be in that position. It may sound counterintuitive, but oftentimes what we hear that's counterintuitive is oftentimes true.
I had such a hard time letting go of it that I took all my notes and I put them into a book. So most people don't want the book, but it basically says, here are all the things that I was referencing when I was making the game. And that was my release valve, because then I could just take those ideas that even if our kids aren't orange pilled at a certain time, maybe someday down the road, they will be. And I want to have something that's there. And so my vision is, as we continue to put out games based on first principles, is to have a book that goes with each of them. So that for those that want to do self-learning or directed learning or whatever it is, it basically gives them a starting point. It doesn't say that this solves everything for you. It just says, here's where I started. here are the things that influence me. And if it helps you, then great. And I, it's almost a, it's a release for me to say, it's okay not to put this in the final game because I'm going to stick it over here anyway. And then I just feel good that it's somewhere. I don't have to, I've shared it. If no one looks at it, okay. But I still feel better because I found a home for it. Somewhere, maybe for somebody, that'll be a starting point. So
totally. That's a really great approach. Instead of censoring ourselves to put out certain information and don't put out certain information, it's good to have to put out all of the information and have the consumer self-select, like to self-select what makes sense to them and self-select if they want to go for one step further. Is this make sense for them? It saves their time too. Because if all of this information are kind of crunched together, then they don't know how to filter. And it takes a lot of effort and energy to filter. And if you do that filtering for them with all of the information included, then you're helping them be more sovereign too, because they have a choice to decide where they want to land. You also talked about on some other shows about this concept of having zero time preference. We know as Bitcoiners, low time preference is a very fundamental concept that we Bitcoiners share and then conduct ourselves with. But you talk about zero time preference. This is to bring low time preference to an extreme. So first, what is zero time preference? And then the second is, what does it mean to live with zero time preference?
Right. So if you imagine a horizon, it's a concept. You can never actually reach the horizon. It's just a concept, right? So I'm not actually saying you can get to zero. But if you think of an infinite game, there's a book. I forget the author's name right now. But if you think of
Simon Sinek.
Thank you. Think of things that are bigger than yourself. So if you're the Constitution as an example, if there's something that's worth fighting for that's bigger than yourself, that's really more of what the concept is getting at. It's just think about not only throughout your entire life, your low time preference for staying healthy and living a long, healthy life, but your kids and their kids and the way beyond where you can see. Extend your horizon even further. Just keep going. What is something bigger than yourself that you feel passionate about and you want to contribute to? So long after I'm here, if my games are still influencing people, then that's a good thing. So,
right, that's legacy, right? But yeah. I personally do believe that we can live zero time preference. It's more of a mindset. I can't do that yet. I'm hoping that's almost kind of like activating the God mode thing.
I don't think you can necessarily live it. I think it's a concept. So if you were if something on a horizon is your goal and you're that's the direction you want to go, it helps you make decisions. Maybe you'll make a different decision if you're thinking about the very, very, very long term.
That's totally true. It's kind of like if you shoot for the moon, you land on the star. If you shoot for the star, you land on the branch, kind of thing. Let me explain this. What do I mean here? So I think if you accidentally, or if you reach to a point where you can activate the God mode, it's almost like you're elevating yourself into another dimension. Time, it's a 3D thing. It's a time exists in our three dimensional world to kind of carry us through different space and places and time. The concept itself exists in a three dimensional world, but if our consciousness live above that. Our consciousness is above the 3D world in general, then time can first be, there are different ways to look at it. Time can be non-existent or time can be irrelevant. So there are two ways to look at it. So I personally believe there is a way to live in a place where there's no time preference, the zero time preference. But what it does is it just brings you back to the present moment. It just makes you be present. Because if you eliminate a concept of time altogether, then eternity lies in every moment. And then, but on the flip side, eternity can be kind of reduced to the singularity of the beginning of something, but also the end.
I think in the fiat world, it's exceptionally difficult for people to not live in linear time, because when we say live in the present moment, we almost exclude the need for planning for the future. But the fiat world creates a lot of fear, especially with the increasing inflation. So people need to look to the future because they feel like they have to prepare. They don't know what else to do. And so they look to the future, they look in the past, and they never look at where they are. But it's almost like a product.
Well, I mean, okay, well, since you're going deep on it, the other thing that comes to mind on it is, if you can't see that, then you could lose purpose. If you don't have a meaning in your life, if you can't see past tomorrow because you're so in fear, then
you can see past tomorrow. That's all you focus on is, what am I going to do tomorrow, is what I'm saying. What are you saying?
I'm saying that if you don't have that horizon, if you can't take that longer, whether it's zero or not, maybe you try to get closer to zero. If you can't take a longer view on things, then things have less meaning. And if you have less meaning in your life, then it kind of spirals the other direction.
Well, yeah, why should I exercise? They're on survival mode. Yeah.
Right. Why? So your decisions with relationships, your decisions with substances, exercise, anything.
Do you think living in the present, something like living in the present and be present in general versus having low time preference, is contradicting each other? Because Tally, I see your point in a way, because my parents were just visiting me and I'm single, and my parents are like, oh, you have to think about where you want to like live for your kids going, for them to go to school. Like, what is a good school district? But I'm like, I'm single. Like my kids are probably at my toes right now. They're not pop up anytime soon. And from that point to going to school, that's like 7-8 years, and it's funny that they think that. But I get where they're coming from. It's because going to a good school makes a difference in their mind, and they think you should plan ahead, you should have that low time preference for your future generation. And they're well intentioned, just like Bitcoiners, and they are being low time preference, but it's because they're conditioned in a fiat world that this is how they think. But, and then on the flip side of things is that if we adopt that low time preference and we see Bitcoiners forego a wedding, forego a vacation to stack sats, and I fully applaud that, but are you missing out here? You only live once and your kids only grow up once. How do you balance being low time preference and stack sats and planning to have that zero time preference while living a present life and enjoy the present moment?
The question that I would ask is, to me, it goes back to the meaning. So the Bitcoin itself doesn't have meaning. It's what are you going to do with that? So if you criticize someone because they use their Bitcoin, but they built their dream house or they went on a dream trip with their significant other, or their dream was to get their kid through school or build a company. If what you're investing your time on is for a meaning, and then Bitcoin helps you achieve that meaning, then that's awesome. But if the Bitcoin itself, I don't think is going to fulfill you. Maybe I'm wrong. If you're just happy with stats, then good on you. Most people though, you want to spend it on what gives you meaning. And if you're not sure what your meaning is, then just, I guess, keep stacking until you figure it out. But I think you have to kind of think through what you want. And if you don't know that, you're just kind of hoping that somewhere along the way that some opportunity is just going to smack you and wake you up, and you're saying, oh, that's what I wanted. That person, that job, that whatever it is that you want. If you don't have a meaning though, I don't know what you're doing. And if you do have a meaning and Bitcoin gets to a certain level where you can achieve that, that's a really great thing. That means someone did something that they wanted to do.
This goes back to a discussion we actually had in my panel of the Creator Summit as well, that I talked about how money is an energy, whether it's Bitcoin or US dollars or Chinese yuan, it doesn't matter. It's an energy. And in and of itself, doesn't bring happiness to anyone. What do hodlers want to do? They want one day to be able to exchange it for something else. They're holding it as an asset, but there are other assets in the world that are just as valuable. So for example, when we decided to homeschool and I stayed at home, we have frequent conversations about whether or not I should go back to work, in which case we would then be able to build up our nest egg. We can take these fancy vacations and we can pay down our student loans faster. But we decided that our treasure was in our kids and what they are able to experience in the time. So every chance that I had for them to experience something and learn something from it, I forked out money for it. But it wasn't like, okay, I did that. And I also put money away for stocks. If you have $1, it can't go to both places. It goes to one place. And so we didn't have the fancy vacations and we didn't buy fancy clothes. I got my clothes from the grocery store. I got it from Sam's Club. When I went to shop for food, I got my shirts there, you know? But that was our treasure. And so today, so that was a while ago, but today we're building Free Market Kids. We also just had a conversation saying, if we have both just gone and gotten a job and put our money in Bitcoin, we probably would be a lot more comfortable than we are today. But we're fighting. We're fighting to build up this company that educates other people about Bitcoin and money literacy.
Right.
So our treasure is in that. And so it is a really difficult conversation because I do hear people say things like, you know, have fun being poor, or, you know, it's not too late, put your money in Bitcoin because one day it's going to have this huge payoff. But the question goes back to what you said, which is, what about the present moment? Because life is not about the one day payoff. Mm. Life is about every single day, every moment. What are you experiencing? Is what you're doing bringing a song to your heart? You know, if we get really cheesy about it, like, is your heart singing every morning when you get up? Right? So if it makes your heart sing to put your sats away, wonderful. But if you would rather get married, don't feel guilty. Because that's life. You don't know if you're going to be alive in 10 years. Nobody has guarantees of that. You know, when people are predicting that Bitcoin's going to hit $1 million, are we going to be around? Who knows?
Tally, you said $1 cannot be spent at two places. So you have to prioritize. And then Scott, you were saying you have to know what you want. And then what lies deeper than that is, before you know what you want, you have to understand who you are. And that goes back to trying. We have to find out about ourselves. What kind of person are we, and what role do we want to play in this world? And then the wants will arise. Because I need to be that person, because I want to do this thing, then I need to do this, and I want to do this. So it really comes down to having self-awareness and having more conversations with ourselves and trying to figure out, what role do I play in this world and how can I get there? And Bitcoin is really the means to an end. It's not the end. And I struggle to see how Bitcoiners who don't understand that, who can be happy, even if they have all the Bitcoin in the world, if they don't know what to do with it, then I don't think they're in a very good position. So I think this is an important message to be shared, especially with the next generation, because they will, especially if they're lucky and then their parents stack sets, so they will be in a more comfortable position and be better positioned to begin thinking about these more important questions. So that's going to be a really lucky thing for our next generation. And speaking of which, let's talk about the next generation. And very, very impressive of you too is the fact that you've homeschooled 4 children, and it's been spanning across 20 years. That's a long time and that's a lot of kids to go through homeschooling. So I bet you have a lot of experimenting and little setbacks, but really pushed through this entire process and have built something that's really robust, that supported all of your kids. But I heard that there were initial pushback.
And so Tali mentioned it. She wanted to have that relationship with her kid. So if you go, you start your family, but then you go to work and you hire a nanny, and after you pay taxes and you pay the nanny, and you look at how much incremental money you've made with that compared to how much time you've lost with your kids in their key part of their development, and which one of those things is more valuable to you, right? So that's on the positive side, is the relationship. But there's a lot of bad things to avoid in schools, and And I think you have to be open-minded that the people who are making recommendations to you are coming from a fiat mindset. You should get a credit card. You should max out whatever your monthly cash flow is to get the biggest, best car that you can think of getting. And you should go to college. That was another one. So for our families to, one, when we were going to homeschool, it was almost an insult. It was, what are you doing? Why are your kids aren't going to be socialized. There's all this fear based on it. And you're giving up this career. You went to Yale. You're now a stay-at-home mom. What are you thinking? And it seemed like that was somehow a double insult on the Asian side. So it was like, it wasn't just bad. It was monumentally bad. What are you doing? And then our kids, when they got to the point where they were thinking about school, we have two girls and two boys, and the boys tried it and said, this is not for us. And so now the families are looking at us like we're crazy again, saying, you went all the way up to your master's and you're telling your kids they don't have to go to school. And we're just looking at it going, well, first, what are they going to get? The school prices they're inflating because of all the administrators that they're bringing in, way more than the stated inflation. They're not going to be able to get out of student debt with the job they're going to get with that. And if they did get a job, they'll probably be miserable with it because it's probably not aligned with what they want to do. So if they went and earned money and they learned on it, there's so many ways of learning now, online and other things that you can do. We should be leveraging that technology. So you really need to question whoever is making that recommendation to you, what is their framework? If their framework is this fiat system that says you should eat these foods and you should go into debt and go to school and you should do this and this. And I think it's a first principle thing. You just need to ask, what is it that you're really getting out of those things? And what is your real opportunity cost for that? And it's, if you do that, then I think what it comes down to is making the commitment. So Tali said, I want to try it. I said, let's try it. The worst that can happen is a couple of years go by and when the kids goes back to school or something, there's a very low risk to it. But once you got to make that commitment to try it. And just like you're going to try to do your business, you're going to try to do whatever it is that you're going to do. But homeschooling is really misunderstood. And I think people are being biased by, they're being influenced by the people around them who are very, very high time preference focused and fear-based. And once you get past that, you see how free you can really be. And it's hard to explain that to someone who feels the pressure of the fear. So I know that our families, they never came to us for any other reason than they loved us and they wanted the best for us. It's very hard to explain to them that like what they were recommending didn't fit with what we thought was best. Right. And
I want to say that we did meet a lot of resistance on both sides, from my side because of the Asian expectation of, you know, you get your master's, you work a really nice job, you have the fancy house and the big vacations and all that stuff. And then on his side, because both of his parents worked in the public school system, they were insulted by what our decision was, because like, what's wrong with public school? We raised you in the public school. Are you saying we did a bad job kind of thing? I'm like, no, that has nothing to do with that. Mm. One of the most influential books that really impacted me when the kids were little, like I said, I went into homeschooling not knowing anything. Really, I went into parenting not knowing anything except the traditional, like Confucius kind of, you know, the parent authority is absolute and you got to respect your elders. Like other than that, I really had very little practical parenting understanding. But one of the books that was really impactful for me was a book by a lady called Jennifer Fox. And she wrote, and it's called, I'll send you the link, but it's called Discover Your Child's Strength. And it talks in the first chapter about how the world's changing. And this book was written over 20 years ago when globalization was just starting to happen. And companies are hiring from overseas over the internet. That was right at the beginning of that. And they were talking about how our public school system or our general education setup is to make sure that everybody can do at least mediocre level of a bunch of subjects, 6 or 7 subjects, right? That all the students are required to do. And the focus of the school and the education is to make sure that you strengthen your weakest subject. So you spend your whole career and, you know, you get A's, 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 and a B. Your after school hours are spent on bringing that B up to A, because for whatever reason, they expect everybody to have the same set of skills, which is very strange because people are made so differently. And so this lady, Jennifer Fox, said, what if instead of making everybody mediocre in six subjects, we make each person the best in the world in the subject that they are naturally inclined to do. And just don't worry about these other stuff. Like, does it really matter if everybody can do algebra? No, it doesn't matter whatsoever. But think about the hours and hours and hours wasted on kids who hate math. They're like, you have to at least pass algebra. You know, the money and the self-confidence that's like hurt and bruised because, oh my God, I'm so bad in math. I must be a stupid person. No, but if you're really artistic and you're just like the best, if you got 40 hours a week to work on what your strength is, can you imagine the distance you can go? And so the book talks about how that whole system is kind of backwards. Right now we're talking about, you know, the wasteful administration costs and the wasteful, you know, the retirement and the woke agenda, all that stuff. But if you really get to the heart of education, what are we trying to do? Are we trying to strengthen their weakest subject, or are we trying to make them the best in their best subject? And then they can compete globally, right? Then you can compete globally. And that book really held me through the criticism from both sides of the family when I was trying to do what I believe was right with the four kids, and we moved a lot, and it was a very lonely, really hard journey. But I just kind of held on to that book. I'm like, I'm gonna make this book, not my Bible, but like, I'm gonna make this book a reality in my kids' life. I want them to be able to go after what they're good at and they're naturally passionate about, because that's the only way they're gonna become the best and be competitive, as people say.
Now that you've gone through this process, what kind of families would make sense to homeschool their kids? Because I personally struggle to see how this can be a solution for all families out there. Or you can either that's because of how their economical situation, or how their family set up, and how educated the parents are, or other, I'm sure there are a million other factors that can impact how this is carried out on a decade basis. So in your view, like, what are some of the key factors they should line up before they can consider homeschooling? And where you can indeed make a case that literally everyone should homeschool their children?
Well,
I'll just say that when we started homeschooling, the resources were much more limited, and there's a lot more out there now available online than there ever was. And there are many, many options of homeschooling. Homeschooling just means the parents get to decide what the kids are learning, but they don't have to be the teachers specifically. So for example, I knew this one family, she was a single mom, she had a son, and she worked a full-time job. And she homeschooled him when she got home. And during the day, he stayed with grandma. But grandma wasn't homeschooling him. She took him around, you know, as she was living her life, and helped her in the kitchen, went to the store with her and the bank and everything. And even in those field trips, he's learning, right? But when his mom came home, she did the academics. Mm-hmm. So that's one example. Another example is moms who work part-time. They can put their kids in what I call part-time private school, which is basically a drop-off situation. You drop them off in the morning, you pick them up in the afternoon. The teachers give the assignments, they do the teaching. You just make sure they do the homework. And the benefit is you get to pick the teacher, you get to pick their subject, and you get to be very, very involved. Nobody's going to be like, this is what your kids absolutely have to do, because you just pick them up and you take them to another place. Full control, right? So that's what I will call part-time private school. But again, the parents are not doing the teaching and they can still work a part-time job. Mm-hmm. And then you go all the way to the other end of the spectrum where people do unschooling. And so both parents are working and the kids are with them. So that's a specific kind of setup. They either have their own business, or maybe they live a farm or something like that. And the kids are just learning through their life activities, and they're not necessarily doing academic subjects. So that's all the way to the other end of the spectrum. Two, for me, I was very, very involved. I taught most subjects, but there were subjects where I just didn't have time to do. So for example, science classes, just setting up an experiment that lasts 10 minutes can take me 3 hours. And I can't do that because in those 3 hours, I have to cook and clean and do the dishes and the laundry, and I have to teach them the other subjects. So I outsource science classes. So once a week, I would take them to a place where they just went and took science classes, and I picked them up. I don't have to teach. I don't do homework. They taught, the teacher taught, and the kids asked questions and whatever that way. And so there's so much flexibility. Really, anybody who wants to homeschool can homeschool.
Do you trust somebody else to influence your kids' experience and their mental frameworks? Or are you going to do everything you can to help impact that and actively contribute to it? So you're either outsourcing it and hoping, or you're going to actively participate. Homeschooling is a flavor of active participation, but I think the responsibility is on the parents. And no matter what your circumstances, you can still talk to your kid. You can still read to them. You can still play games. You can do sports together. There's a lot of other things you can do to help them with what they need for the mental frameworks.
I also think that the most important part in this picture of homeschooling or supplemental schooling after school, you know, for parents who can't homeschool, is to make sure you have a strong relationship with your kids that's open and healthy. Because if they have to go to public school or private school because of your job situation or your financial situation, but you have a really wonderful relationship with your kids, you can still teach them all kinds of stuff. I think the most detrimental is when they go away to school and you don't have a relationship with them and you try to tell them stuff, then they're not going to listen. You know, so if you just get the relationship right and you'll figure it out, whether you, if that means full-time homeschool, part-time homeschool, or they go to public or private school.
Well, we all have very complicated relationship with our parents, but it's very true that to have that healthy relationship with your parents, it's so important. And the emotional intelligence and the emotional strains that you get from your childhood interacting with your parents, they serve you for a lifetime. And just like we talked about how people learn through games without realizing it's learning, the parents parenting without knowing that they are parenting. They're just conducting, they're just bringing the kids to work or do whatever, just carrying through their lives. But kids are so young and new and fresh, and they absorb literally everything. So if you are a parent that's bad mannered, your kids are going to pick up from you just by observing. And then when you tell them, oh, you need to have good manner, you have to do this and that, they won't respect you, and then they won't listen to that because you're not leading by example. What is the biggest challenge a family has to overcome to go down the path?
I think the greatest challenge, Vivian, is you have to understand that it will be an all-consuming thing. Because if you go work a job, you get to leave. If you're mothering and homeschooling, you never get to, you never get off the clock. It is a 24/7 job. And I have spoken to some young women who are afraid that they're going to lose themselves when they homeschool, because they're never going to have free time again. They're just, that's it. Their life is on hold for 20 years, whatever. And it did feel that way a little bit sometimes. But today there are so many support groups where moms come together and they share the workload, and they're called homeschooling co-ops. So you don't have to do it yourself. It is not an isolated thing. It was a little harder when we were doing it because there were a little bit less people doing it. But today, there are all kinds of homeschooling groups out there. And it is also okay for you to homeschool for a while and say, you know what, I can't do it anymore. Mm-hmm. The kids are going to go back to school. You haven't failed. You've laid a foundation that will serve them. So that's also okay. And some people let their kids go back to school and the kids decide they want to come back into homeschooling, and then they take charge of their own education and they become self-educators. I've heard stories like that also. So,
let me try this, Vivian. If I were to go back and give my self advice 20 years ago or 25 years ago, and that horizon perspective we were talking about, where you take this very long-term view, you can call it zero time preference, whatever, and you challenge yourself and say, okay, So in one of those futures, you're going to be able to tell your family or tell yourself or whoever's around you, man, I had a really great career. I made all kinds of PowerPoints, or I sold millions of dollars of whatever it was, or I have so many properties, something. Another one could be, I have four fantastic kids that I have a loving relationship with, and we've done all kinds of things together, and now they have grandchildren, and you have these relationships. And so if I could go back 20 years, 25 years, and say, you could go pursue your fiat job and worry about the title you have, the prestige of the industry you're in, the size of your house, or whatever it is that you're judging yourself by. And maybe your classmates will judge you by that, or your parents will judge you. Hey, how come you're not a lawyer? How come you're not a doctor? Or, you know, whatever pressure there might be. You can say, no. If you want to look back and say, I was a really great mom, or I was a really great dad, and I have relationships, and then work backwards to the present and ask yourself a question about, is homeschooling, or however you want to say this involved parenting style, which path am I going to be on? And am I going to make a commitment that I want to be on this path? And if I am, then it makes the things that Tali's talking about a lot easier, because you're not looking at it going, wow, 24/7, that sounds horrible, right? You know, say, but if you're thinking about that low time preference, if you're thinking about the very long time preference, you're not thinking about that. You're thinking, I'm not doing this because I want to be miserable. I'm doing this because what's valuable for me is the relationships and this experience. And I know that I will put them into the best position possible for them to have a good life. Is that what I want? Or do I want it to say, I had a really great career, and hope that along the way, so if you're not running your own company, that no one laid you off?
Well, I also want to add on top of that, also, there has been a huge push over the last few decades for women to have both career and family. That was a big message that was being pushed as I was coming out of college. And all of us bought into it. We all thought we could do it. We could have an amazing career and we can have an amazing family. But the truth is, it's the same as the dollar. If you spend it in one place, you can't spend it again another place. And so for us looking back, well, our son also just got married and it was very, very sweet. And his wife is also a homeschooler, and almost most of the guests at the wedding, they were all homeschoolers, like almost all of them. And what I absolutely loved about that is I can say, I know my son very well. He knows me very well. We have a very good relationship. The siblings love each other. We're very supportive. Same thing on his wife's side. I mean, the whole community just came together and just loved on them. And I just don't think that if I had gone into investment banking the way that I originally planned to do, that I would have that kind of relationship with them. It's not possible, because my time would be spent in the office. And they would not know me at all, and I wouldn't know them. So, yeah, 24/7 sounds really scary, but again, there is a lot of support.
You do have a lot of support.
You can do it.
You have support groups. You have the technology with education now. You can teach so many things in so many ways.
Thanks for the disclaimer, because 24/7 does sound hella scary.
Okay, let me ask you this, though. Do you know anybody who feels that they are tied that way to their job anyway?
You
get a phone call at night. Maybe even if they're not getting a phone call from their boss at those times, they're so stressed about the things going on at work that they can't relax and they can't enjoy life. And so it's 24/7 of one type of stress, or it's 24/7 of a different type of stress, but at least it's on the path to something better.
Right. And for you, because Tali, you basically foregoed a career to focus on, really, really focus on this. So how were you specializing? How in a family to pull off such thing, to homeschool four children with a single income? How involved Scott is in the homeschooling process and vice versa for Tali?
I did most of it myself. He was in a fiat job that demanded his attention 24/7. He would get phone calls 3 o'clock in the morning, and I would have to wake him up and be like, your work is calling. I mean, on the weekends, on nights, he was working. And a lot of times we had to take vacations without him because he couldn't get off work. And in that way, if we had to do it all over again, I'm not sure that we could have done it differently, but we really would have preferred to do it differently.
I would have definitely, because I was so tied up in what my title was and that I had to provide for the family with medical. And I, as opposed to saying, this place that I'm in is the wrong place to be in, and I'm burning myself out, which never ends well. And I would have made a different decision on that stuff. So you can learn from my mistakes. I'm just telling you.
We also made a number of moves for corporate jobs.
And so
it was because of that. And so we not only had resistance on both sides of the family, but we also moved many times. Mm. And we had our four kids very close in age. And so, and he was working all the time. So it was a really huge challenge for me. I was doing most of it, but I was part of different co-ops, so I was never alone. I always had other parents that I could bring my kids to. Like that that image of the kids must be sitting in the closet reading books as a homeschooler, like that is so untrue. We were on the road all the time because we were going to soccer practice, we were going to gymnastics, we were going to a co-op, and we're going to take a cooking class. We're going to go here, we're going to go to the zoo with the other homeschooling parents, and we're going to take another field trip here, and we're going to do a play, and we're going to do a musical, and we're in the choir. And so we're all constantly moving, and the kids are interacting with other parents all the time, other kids. And so that phrase that it takes a village to raise a child is very, very true. I couldn't have done it myself. And even though he was stuck at work most of the time, our kids were able to see so much of life because we were just interacting with life. We weren't in a room in our house with four desks and a blackboard, and then that's all their exposure. I wish you could have met my daughter when we were in Nashville. She was helping us at the game lounge, but they know how to interact with people to the point where I think there was, this is several years ago during COVID, and we were in an online workshop, and one of the moms wrote me a private text and said, "These two girls are yours." I'm like, "Yes." And she said, "If you write a book on parenting, I will buy it because I cannot believe how well they're able to interact with people because they interact with people all the time." And so even if, you know, some of your listeners, you're thinking, okay, if we go for this and my husband's working, that means he's going to have to work two jobs and I'm going to be doing all this by myself. And what am I going to do with all my kids? Life is wonderful in teaching kids. That's natural. Kids will pick up, like what you said, they will pick up by interacting with people, not just with the parents. They see, they gather data. They're not stupid. They're very smart, and they can deduct their own understanding and lessons out of these interactions, which will be really helpful.
Well, let me say to this too. So now our kids are older, but we still have this relationship with them. And then it was only 20 months ago that Tali and I decided that we're going to go full time on free market kids. The fear that I had to overcome to say, I'm not going to go back and do what I've always done in the past and go pursue a fiat job with somebody else and just go live that kind of stress. They're observing that, and they're not judging me by my title. Hey, you're the game guy. They don't care that I don't have a fancy title. And actually, one of our daughters actually said this, what they're actually witnessing is they're watching how we're dealing with things. First of all, we're a couple, we're still together, which that's strange, right? And we're dealing with a lot of these high time preference stresses, but we're doing it together. So that's just an example for them. And we're trying to pursue something that we're passionate about, that's our dream. Now, we may have started a little bit later than they'll be able to, but one of our daughters said, "I admire what you guys are doing. I really admire, because I don't know, 20 months ago, if you had said, first of all, that I'd even be on a podcast, let alone can do one with Tali, that we would have been in El Salvador, that we would be doing, meeting so many amazing people and doing all these things, I just would have thought you were crazy. I just wouldn't have believed it. And the kids are watching us, and we're, even though we had the pressure of building a business, we're more fulfilled than ever from that standpoint. And the kids are watching that. And because we have a relationship with that, they're able to see that. And even though we're not sitting down and saying, okay, guys, we're going to have a lesson on how you plan out your career. No, they're witnessing what we're doing. Even though the formal education is over, you're still the parent and they're still watching and they're still learning from your example. So it never really ends either. Mm-hmm. Right. So, if when your kid tells you, I'm really proud of what you guys are building and you're building together, it kind of takes your breath away. You're like, where did that come from?
It feels really good.
Well, I mean, how many people, there's a lot of parents that struggle with the relationship with their parents. And that to me is an amazing, like, you can't take that away from me. That's my experience. That's my life experience now. And had I stayed with that other, the job I had previously, first of all, I wasn't really happy there. They later went bankrupt anyway. So we would have been right back to the same pattern we were before. And instead, we're meeting amazing people, we're working on things that we think are going to make a difference in the world. And then our kids are watching this and they're observing what we're doing and they're learning from it as well. So we're continuing to teach them without formally saying, okay, kids, let's take out we're going to have a lesson now on career planning and
entrepreneurship.
No, they're just watching us do this. So it just all works together when you do it. And then you're like, oh, that makes sense.
Right.
It just feels right. Whereas everything else before, it felt like you were fighting everything. When you get things to work together, there's a different rhythm to flow with the relationships.
Definitely. And how have homeschooling in general impacted your relationship as a couple? Because you have a completely new set of problems to deal with.
I'll tell you what, when he was working and I was homeschooling by myself, I didn't have a problem because I made all the decisions. Just because I was there all the time and the kids did what I believed was right. And I think in hindsight, I would have changed some decisions, but because he was busy and we didn't have to make all the decisions together, we didn't argue about things. Like, it was just me telling him after work he had to meet us here because one kid is having a show and one kid's having a soccer tournament and one kid's, you know.
Or Tali picked up a seventh puppy.
Or I brought him an extra puppy, whatever. Or a goat or something. But it actually became a little bit more challenging when we started this business and we still have one youngest son. He's not in high school anymore, but he's still in our house and we were still trying to guide him. But that was when we had to really talk through some decision making, because then he was here and I couldn't just do what I wanted to do. So
yin and yang
open,
in the relationship.
Open communication is key.
So my part in the homeschooling thing was to be supportive when there were extra animals in the house, or she wanted to build a fort in the basement, or whatever ideas that she had, that there were things where basically instead of me trying to argue with it, there would be tension, but I would support whatever the endeavor was. And so now the kids have these memories of very strange things. I mean, you can imagine a house, you're homeschooling, so you have four kids and the seven dogs running around. It's just, and there's just piles of books everywhere. It was just, I don't know how you explain it. The house was alive.
To play a supporting role in such a big thing, it's very wise for you to do, Scott, because I can imagine you both come from, like, you're both very intelligent individuals, and I can imagine both of you being in opinionated and have your preferred way of doing things. And if both parents try to make decision for absolutely everything, it could be chaotic and it could be causing like extra frustration. And Tali, this question is for you, because you forgo a career. And one of my own fear of doing something like this, I totally see the benefit of this. Before, I didn't like consider it at all. And I didn't think it was an option. And now I'm considering this. But my fear here is that what if you get married and you have kids with this man, and then you're living off one income and then raise your children this way? So I wouldn't have an income and I would feel insecure, or I would in whatever way. Like, this is a fear or a concern that I have. So were you struggling with anything like this, and how were you navigating through that?
Are you saying in case he loses his job or in case he leaves you?
Both.
And you get divorced.
Yeah.
Oh, both. Okay.
Or she could leave him.
Or you can leave him. Right. Yes. Yeah. So the strange thing is that was never a concern I had, because I knew I could make money because of my work experience. And it was just not something, I think there was definitely something my mom, the concern my mom raised. She goes, what if Scott decides to leave you and you got fat after having four kids and now you're stuck and, you know, they can't go to school because you homeschool them at last
time. I don't understand the Chinese word.
I personally did not have that fear because I knew that our understanding of each other and where we're coming from and our life values were really aligned. And so when he, in 2008, we were going through the first financial crisis, the major, major financial crisis. And in the city where we lived, 40,000 people were laid off at the same time. And he was one of them. And my mom was like, oh my God, what are you going to do now? Are you going to go find a job? And I said, no, because I trust that he's going to figure it out because he's a man. And I don't need to worry because he'll take care of it. So, because it's a division of labor. We've been so conditioned, Vivian, you and I, probably more so you because I'm a bunch older than you are. But anyway, we've been so conditioned that we have to be able to do everything, that we have to be independent, that we can't need anybody, right? But the truth is, human beings are born to work together. We're supposed to be in a community. If your husband loses his job or decides to leave you, okay, and you still have a community around you, you'll be okay. They're gonna support you. The only reason you have that fear is if you feel like you have to do everything and you have nobody that you can depend on whatsoever. And I didn't really necessarily have a community around me because of us moving around and everything, but I just knew that he's gonna take care of it. He's gonna be okay. And I personally didn't have that fear, so I'm not sure what kind of recommendation I can make. But just know the man that you're marrying, if you guys talk about it openly and you both decide to do this, then you can't be fearful of what life is gonna throw you. Because you don't know what's gonna happen.
We're gonna keep doing he said, she said. I'll give you advice. Okay. I'll give you advice as the man.
Number one,
yeah. Because what she's telling you is you got to go find the perfect man, and you you got to go. And then if he doesn't, it doesn't work. It hasn't allayed your fears at all. So number one, I think for me, that a healthy relationship, both parties have to be a whole person. Mm. So if you are defining who you are based on who he is, oh, I'm the doctor's wife, I'm the whatever, then you're vulnerable. But if you are you and you have your hobbies and you have your interests and you are a whole person before you met him, and you don't lose who you are. Now you come together as a couple and you have your couple personality, but it's not going to be a healthy relationship if one or the other is defining who they are based on that relationship. So you're going to have to be a whole person. So if you're struggling with a lot of things yourself, then just getting into a relationship is probably not going to be a solution for you. It'd be my guess. The second thing that I would say for advice is, if you still have that fear, there are so many ways today, and you're doing it right now, right? You say on the side, I'm going to do a podcast because I want to talk to interesting people. You can do art. You can do music. You can do podcasts. You can, I don't know, maybe you're an accountant. You can do whatever it is that you want to do. You can still do that. And you don't necessarily have to be in an office anymore because of the way work has changed and the way technology has changed. So you have more options than were ever available before. So I would say, one, work on yourself, be whole, and you're going to be okay. Because now you're not worried. If he leaves, then he's the one that misses out, right? And two, just realize you have so much potential just in yourself. You can work on those things. So whatever it is that you want to work on, you have more options available now than have ever been available for people to do work from different locations with different skill sets.
Thank you for the candid advice. This is all really well received. And how do our listeners stay close to your work?
All right. So right now, freemarketkids.com actually is where we'll be posting. We keep posting our products there. So if you're interested in the homeschooling aspect in particular, then following our podcast, Bitcoin Homeschoolers, which is just bitcoinhomeschoolers.com.
You can go to orangehatter.com, and that's where I post things on about my weekly reading group, which is on Monday nights, and my women's mastermind for women entrepreneurs in the Bitcoin space. That's on Tuesday nights. And then we'll do the annual retreat, but I don't have one scheduled right now. So just keep referring back. My newest project is my daughter and I have teamed up to work on a series called Super K Adventures. And you can find information on super-k.com. So super-k.com. And all the information will be there. And you can also find it through Orange Hatter as well, because it's part of that whole I'm trying to reach moms of young kids. I want to orange pill people indirectly kind of thing.
Thank you so much for taking the time to chat through this. You guys have to come back again, and we'll dive deep into some of the other topics. Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Live with Bitcoin. Remember to like, subscribe, and leave us a comment. I'm your host, Vivian, and we'll see you in the next episode.